Hey, Carrie, how is it with your soul today?
It's April, and it's springtime, and I've been longing for flowers, so I'm doing pretty well with that.
I'd say the same about myself. The sun is out. It's a welcome relief from the hard winter we've had, and I'm very much looking forward to today's conversation with Phil Gulley. So, welcome to The Growing Edge, everyone. I'm Parker Palmer.
And I'm Carrie Newcomer.
To the words and habit between us, and to us and how we live between the words.
I am so delighted to welcome author, pastor, theologian Philip Gulley to the Growing Edge podcast today. Phil Gulley has written 22 books, including the Harmony series, recounting life in an eccentric Quaker community in Harmony, Indiana, several collections of essays, including the best-selling Porch Talk, a memoir called I Love You, Miss Huddleston, which was a finalist for the Thurber Prize for American Humor. In addition, he has co-authored with James Mulholland several works of theology and progressive faith, including If Grace is True, If God is Love, followed by If the Church Were Christian and The Evolution of Faith. You can also read Phil's essays and commentaries regularly in the Indianapolis Monthly and Saturday Evening Post, as well as his new Substack offering, Plain Talk with Philip Gulley. I've personally known and collaborated with Phil in a number of spoken word and music programs, and in my experience, he is the real thing. A source of wisdom and hope and a major prophetic voice in these challenging times. Welcome, Phil, to the Growing Edge.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you, Parker. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, Phil, I've got so many questions I want to ask you. I'm a great fan of your books, both on the levitas side and on the gravitas side. I love the humor and I love the really challenging writing you've done about the church and politics. Let me start, though, with a question that we always like to ask our guests. How did you get to be you? What's that red thread that goes back to the early days and brings you along the path of your own calling over all these years? I'm especially interested to know where that sense of humor comes from. What can you tell us about the journey that has brought you to this calling and to this day?
Well, I come by both traits, honestly. My parents never used the term humorist, but that's what they were. My mother was an educator. My father was a salesman. Two jobs that required consummate people skills. And they navigated those vocations very deftly by using humor and a soft word, and both did very well at what they did. They were both very, also, especially my father, very politically involved and passionate about politics and their role in culture and society. And so I remember as a child that being the topic of many of our dinner conversations. I don't know what Dad would make of today's reality. He always lamented that the worst day in American history was when Richard Nixon resigned, a sentiment I shared at the time, but then I was only 13. But he was from that strain of the Republican Party that seems to be missing these days, and that was the, you know, the inherited party of Lincoln that really meant something. That party is no more.
And were you always called to a spiritual path? I mean, you're a pastor and an author. I mean, you have a couple things going on there that are very busy, demanding lives.
Oh, gosh, no. I hated church as a kid. I absolutely hated it. And when I was 14, I told my mother that I didn't want to go to Catholic Mass anymore. And that was the age of emancipation, as it turns out. She said, okay, I will not compel you to go. And as I say, I didn't go anywhere for 2 years. And then one Sunday afternoon, I was seated on our front porch in our porch swing. It was a beautiful summer evening. And I saw carload after carload of young Quaker teenage girls pull up and go into our neighbor's house. They were the local youth group leaders, and I heard the voice of God telling me to go be a Quaker, and so I did. But I do remember the first time I became really enlivened. I was at Quaker meeting, and it was my first Sunday there. I'd gone to youth group for several months, and they invited me to go to meeting for worship, and so I did. And the pastor gave this sermon didn't sit well with some of the congregation. He was far more conservative than the rest of the congregation. And this woman in the meeting, after he had spoken, stood up and suggested that there were other ways to look at the topic he had been discussing. And she kind of reframed it. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this would never happen in a Catholic church, and they're going to kill her. And they didn't. In fact, afterwards, when the pastor closed the meeting for worship, he thanked her and said that she had given him much to think about. And I remember being blown away by that, the idea that theology could be a conversation as opposed to a dictation, as opposed to an order. It could be a conversation one could join instead of a dissertation one had to endure. And that just rocked my world.
Especially a conversation between someone with a theological education and someone who probably did not have that, either benefit or liability.
Yeah, in this instance, it was the woman standing to speak who had the theological education, and the pastor didn't. Uh-huh. He had gotten the job by virtue of being the son-in-law of the head of the search committee, and he needed a job.
another example of how God moves in mysterious ways.
Right. And people always ask me, where do you get your story ideas? And you just...
Living?
They're just ripe for the picking.
Yeah. So what was the dawning for you of this notion that you might want to pursue something in relation to the church, to ministry, as an adult, and pursue an educational path and then a vocational path? Where did that start to set in, and where did that take you?
I was 21 and attending Plainfield Friends meeting here in Indiana. And as you know, in the Quaker tradition, one does not stand and announce that they are called to ministry. The community notices gifts for ministry and affirms those gifts and urges people then to be useful. Mm. And there was a woman in our meeting named Annis Carter who approached me when I was 21 and invited me to consider that. And so I thought about that for 2 years, and decided that that would be something I would enjoy doing. And I quit my job. I enrolled in undergraduate four-year college. At Marion University, studied sociology and theology, and then rolled right into seminary at Christian Theological Seminary and Earlham School of Religion, a joint program that they created for me, and then returned to Plainfield meeting to give a message one Sunday.
Yeah.
And Annis came up to me and said, "Philip, perhaps I was mistaken," but by then I was already into it and loving it. I was one of these persons who, when they went to college and seminary, I just thrived. I absolutely adored the whole process of engagement and reflection and learning. I found it fascinating. I still find it fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, you continue to write about it. You know, you continue to live it as a pastor and as an individual, but you also continue to write about it. And I've read many of your books, Phil, and I've loved them all. I remember sitting on an airplane reading I Love You, Miss Huddleston, and confusing people around me because I was alternately wiping my eyes and laughing out loud. but in preparation for this podcast, I reread If the Church Were Christian, one of your books of theology. And it is an appealing title for those of us whose lives have been impacted by the Gospels, but find our current political expressions of it kind of unrecognizable. I mean, can you tell me about writing that particular book?
Yes. Like many in the church today, I began to notice the huge disconnect between our historic claims, what we claim to value and be central to our faith, and the direction the church was headed, which to me seems to be an utter contradiction of our historic priorities, especially if you're a Quaker. And I thought, that is a book that needs written. And Harper agreed and published it. But here's how quickly the world has changed. Just a few short years after that book was published, I wanted to publish another book called If America Were Great, Our Common Quest for a More Perfect Union, in which I lay out the qualities of what I think make for national greatness. And Harper refused to publish it, telling me it was inconsistent with their publishing objectives.
Wow.
And what had changed in that time was the emerging voice of and growing voice of evangelical Christianity, or Trumpism, I would say MAGA Christianity, that simply feared that any book that critiqued that would not be warmly received by their audience.
Wow, that's sobering.
And so now we begin to see then the shaping of these movements on what can and can't be said or written or published. And that, to me, is worrisome.
For those who don't know the publishing world, I might just add that Harper is a giant in the field. And if Harper is intimidated publishing a book, that's a signal that Americans ought to take very, very seriously.
And Harper is also owned by Rupert Murdoch,
yes,
who owns Fox News.
Yes. I won't tell my story, but that was the point. When he took Harper over, that's when I left Harper many, many years ago. Because it clearly was going to go off in a different direction.
Yeah, it has. And I suspect you're right. I think getting that book published, even though my books have sold well, has been impossible. I haven't been able to find anyone willing to publish it. The refrain I hear commonly is, why would we upset 50% of Americans?
Wow.
And I contend that percentage is much smaller.
I do too.
Yeah, I think right now there's this sense, that evangelical or mega Christianity is the loudest voice in the room because it's the most amplified voice in the room right now. But my sense is that it's not 50%, but it is the most amplified. It's contentious.
Certainly.
It's, it's conflict for media. It's shocking sometimes. So it is very amplified right now.
Right. I think we will get out of it. I'm not sure when or how, but I do think it's, and I'm committed myself to making sure its days are numbered. Yeah.
Well, that's a campaign we want to join you in. I'm really interested in the sort of intimate dimension of this kind of blowback or pushback or rejection of what I regard as a prophetic voice. So it's one thing to have a publisher say, well, look, we've crunched the numbers and we think this is going to be a net loss for us in terms of public support and so forth. But it's another thing to get blowback from within the community that you are, of which you are a prophetic member. And I know that there have been people in the Quaker community, maybe elsewhere, who have basically wanted to get you get your ministerial credentials revoked, as it were, because of the critical stance you've taken toward what I agree, and I'm sure Gary agrees too, is a real misreading, a radical misreading of the gospel and of the message of the church as it's meant to be. How have you, Phil, over the years held this internal blowback from the very community of which you are, as I see it, a faithful member?
Initially, and that process began in 2003, after an article in the Indianapolis Star, in which I was asked whether or not I believed in the divinity of Jesus. And I said, I don't believe Jesus believed in the divinity of Jesus. That is a first century Jewish person, he would have found such a notion incredible, if not heretical. What I quickly learned was that a lot of Quakers who read the Indianapolis Star have no understanding of first century Judaism and think that Christian theology began with Billy Graham. So, of course, they're very committed to that. And this Jesus as the divine figure, the Son of God, whose sole purpose was to save Christians and make sure they go to heaven, which is a fairly new development in theological circles, but those who believe it was the message of Jesus 2,000 years ago, when clearly it wasn't. So for some reason, it never bothered me much because I have just enough ego to think, well, if they knew what I knew, they wouldn't be mad at me. Which is not helpful. I mean, especially isn't helpful if you stand up and say it in front of 300 people. Well, if you knew what I knew, you wouldn't be mad. So I became more adept at articulating my theology. But from 2003 to 2011, at every yearly meeting session, this issue would arise and efforts would be made. And thank God Quakers don't vote, or I would have been out. But there were always weighty friends present who said, friends do not have creeds, and Philip is useful in ministry. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to endure that.
If I'd been in your shoes, it would have flipped me right back to that woman who said, perhaps I was wrong about you, Philip.
Well, and this is the delight, I think, one of the delights of the Quaker community is that now I am the clerk of the committee that records and oversees pastors.
Oh, that's
only in Quakerism is that possible. Right.
So you're as close as Quakers get to the one who holds the keys to the kingdom, right? I like that a lot.
And I try to use that very carefully.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to say, for those who may not be familiar with your books of theology, I want to read just a few chapter titles from this book called If the Church Were Christian to give our listeners an idea of what the blowback is aimed at. And I'd love to hear you, Phil, comment on any piece of this that you'd like. So chapter one in that book is If the Church Were Christian, Jesus would be a model for living rather than an object of worship. Chapter 2, if the church were Christian, affirming our potential would be more important than condemning our brokenness. Chapter 3, if the church were Christian, reconciliation would be valued over judgment. Let me just stop there. All three of those make great sense to me. But they also challenge some very fundamental beliefs, as you said, that are held by a lot of folks who I think misunderstand the gospel. So is there one of those that you'd like to especially comment on? I'm fascinated with the one about affirming our potential, more important than condemning our brokenness.
Well, and that arose out of my observation that that in so many churches, that is the skill they have mastered, is that when I go to church, and the people who go to that church learn primarily that they are flawed, that they are evil without God, that they are full of sin, that no one is righteous, and just a stunning lack of an appreciation for the wonder of humanity and what we can accomplish together. I'm just amazed that that is often is so routinely overlooked and even condemned. Here we are, we're supposed to be made in the likeness of God, in the image of God, and yet are dismissed as having any kind of giftedness, any kind of value or worth, and that when God sees us, all God sees is sin. That just is absurd to me.
And this is the God who, according to that belief system, created us. So what did this God
right.
have in mind to create such a profoundly flawed creature?
Well, I love that routine that George Carlin did about God and hell, about how you'll go to hell where you will burn forever and be tormented for eternity, but he loves you.
Right.
Yeah.
George Carlin, incidentally, to me, was one of the 20th century's finest theologians.
Yeah, I agree.
And I love the humor in that, but also the truth in that. And often I experience that from often reading your stories. It's a thread that runs through all your different kinds of writing, including books of theology, this affirmation of our possibility, our potential, what's already there. It is very Quakerly, that idea mm-hmm. that of God in everyone, you know, that would be a phrase.
We have what we need, yeah. We don't need a savior. We have what we need.
Yeah, all we need is right yeah. here. And to
say that we need a savior then begs the question, saved from what? And of course the church's response to that has been saved from inherent sin. I don't believe that's our primary quality. Though I readily affirm that sometimes evil seems so personal, so malignant, that it does seem sometimes to take on we tend to personify it. That is, I can see why people believe in Satan. If you look at Russia and Ukraine, if you look at the rise of authoritarian governments around the world, it's easy to believe in or it's tempting to believe in a malignant personal force that is out to get us, that is wreaking havoc. But I think one needs to be very careful with that.
It's also, and I'd love to discuss this a little bit before we turn to the question of where do we go from here, which is an important question in this conversation. It seems to me that this problem of religion and politics, and you're a much better church historian than I am, but it seems to me that this problem goes way, way back and is kind of endemic to the nature of the church and the nature of politics itself, so that it's not only as we look around the world and we see manifest evil every day of our lives, it's also that we've got a political system and a religious system that are collaborating in reinforcing this message of what is essentially, I think, social control. If you can convince people mm-hmm. that they're weak and that they need somebody else's approval to live, to be who they are, then you've got the kind of social control that every would-be totalitarian dictator yearns to have and will do anything to set up. So it certainly goes back to the 4th century when the early church got in bed, as it were, with the center of power in Rome. Mm-hmm. And people figured out we can control an illiterate peasant population this way mm-hmm. by convincing them of their own unworthiness and that they have to bow down to us in order to achieve worthiness or salvation in any form.
Right.
That has a lot less to do with the faith journey than it has to do with political power. Who has it, how you keep it, and how you get people to a place where you can manipulate them in the interests of those who want more power and more wealth. Do you see the history of the church the same way?
Oh, absolutely. And I see it. It amazes me at the various places and levels at which that occurs. I mean, look at modern day Russia. And what can only be described as, I think, the collusion between the Putin regime and the Russian Orthodox Church. It's as if they are married. In much the same way, modern American evangelicalism is tied to the Trump movement. He couldn't have done it without them. 72% of American evangelicals voted for him and supported him. And from what I understand in the data I'm reading, that number has not receded all that much, even after January 6th.
This is a baffling thing for me. You know, this is one of the things that I wrestle with a lot, you know, trying to understand and, you know, what the mental gyrations are and heart gyrations that have to happen for that. Though I have often, I said, I'm not the church historian, you are. But I often think of some of those major movements, you know, Christian nationalism as not being a spiritual movement at all, but being really a political movement,
right,
using the trappings of religious language religious kind of,
yeah,
misinformation. Same thing, you know, I think with Trump evangelicalism, I don't think of it as a spiritual movement at all, but more of a political movement. But
right.
I mean, how do you see that?
Well, I think it is definitely a political movement, and I'm always intrigued by people who dismiss Donald Trump as foolish or not very smart. I think he's a genius because he has discerned that by employing the symbols of religion, he can amass great personal power, and he does it masterfully. And if we ignore that, we do so at our own peril.
And he stands on the shoulders of giants, put giants in quote, like Jerry Falwell.
Absolutely.
Who, you know, for whom this was a fine art, going right back to 1980,
right,
and Reagan's election and,
right,
the rise of the religious right. So I think the January 6th reference is interesting because, as I understand it, that fits right in with a certain Christian trope on persecution, and thus we have the guy who lost the 2020 election saying that they aren't convicts, they're hostages. All of those,
yes,
who went to jail because of January 6th.
I had a conversation when I first began writing. It was with an evangelical publisher, and I did not fully appreciate the extent to which that informed what they did. And I didn't last there very long once they found out. You know, I never hid what I believed, and so I was let go by them after four books. But I remember having a talk with the publisher, and he was using us and them language, assuming that I was part of the us. And he said, in reference to progressives, he said, "We will beat them, you know." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, I mean this." He said, "They send their leaders away to study theology. We send our leaders to study communication."
Wow.
And
wow.
I have thought of that conversation hundreds of times since, that is exactly right. That while we were reflecting on the character and nature of God and the role of the church in the world and what it means to be human and all of these very important matters, they were learning how to sell something.
Yeah.
And I think what they did and what they do so much better than us sometimes is that they can sell an idea and make you love it. I hate that that's what has to happen in order to persuade people. But I've lately started asking myself, and this is part of my movement towards Substack, how do we communicate?
Yeah.
How can we sell these ideas that we believe will ultimately be salvific, not only personally, but corporately and culturally, that will give us hope in this world? How do we get that out?
And the Quakerly values that you hold dear, too. I mean, how to communicate those effectively.
Right.
I've been laughing a little bit when I thought about this interview, that we'd have three Quakers on a program, that it'd just be like an hour of silence with little interjections of, "Hi, I think you should rethink that." You know.
And probably constitute 75% of Midwestern Quakers right here on this podcast.
But it's sobering and kind of shocking to hear about that conversation, but there is something in me that is not surprised by it.
Right.
And that idea of becoming more upfront, you know, and that's kind of leading a little bit into our, you know, well, what do we do with this? You know, it's like, I think it's very important. And I think you've been a powerful voice in naming, you know, I think sometimes, you know, the emperor has no clothes, you know, in naming something that's happening. What does this have to do with welcoming the stranger and a life of radical love? And I travel out there a lot, and I do visit all kinds of spiritual communities, and the ones that are thriving, the ones that seem to be really thriving right now, are being clear and upfront that this is a place where we value justice for everyone. This is a place where we welcome everyone, no matter who they are and who they are becoming. And this is a place where we name Christian nationalism as not being a spiritual movement.
Right.
So I think it's very important that the process of naming it, because if it's not said aloud, folks are thinking, am I the only person thinking this, that this doesn't make sense? And then from there, that was a long way to the question of, where do we go from here then? What are the things that you're seeing as positive and helpful in dealing with the movements we're seeing, and not just pushing back on those movements, but also living into a new and different idea than those.
Yeah, modeling something else, witnessing to something else.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me personally, knowing history helps.
Yeah.
So I read Heather Cox Richardson every morning on her Substack page.
Yes.
And boy, she's wonderful.
Yeah.
Her grasp of history and her ability to tell us this is nothing new. This has happened before. It was just a different name, a different time. And so one begins to develop an appreciation for the resiliency of America. And we're not as fragile as we think we are. There have been other demagogues, and we move beyond them, and we will move beyond this one. It will be painful, it will be difficult, but the only way I know to move beyond these things is to do what you have said, and that's to name it, and to say, there's no magic here, friends. This is not the voice of God coming to us through a political movement. This is a man and his misguided quest for power, and those who want to share in that power, whose morality, I believe, is so deeply flawed that they will do and say what they know to be wrong in order to touch the hem of the garment. And it is tragic, but it has always been the case. And the only way I know how to get around that is to live in absolute opposition to it.
Yeah.
In everything we do, to speak against it, to live against it, and to not descend to it.
I'm totally with you there. And on one level, I think that means what each of us does with his or her own vocation. That's one way we have of living into it. What each of us does in relation to our own family and friendship groups. And I think it also means, you know, creating communities that model a different way of living. Another piece of church history among my random collection of factoids that I remember is what Tertullian, the ancient church historian, said about the early church. The early church, of course, was planted at a time when to be a stranger in someone else's territory was to have sentenced yourself to death. I mean, hospitality to the stranger was not a trope throughout the ancient world. Quite the contrary. You just didn't want to wander onto someone else's block and wear the wrong colors or show the wrong signs. Tertullian said that the early church attracted people not because of its theology at all, but because people looked into this collection of strangers gathering in these tiny, often underground groups. People looked in on them and said, "See how they love one another. See how they love one another." That was a quote from Tertullian. It seems to me that that's what we also need today, in addition to our individual vocations and our private lives with family and friends. We need models of community where folks can actually have the experience of seeing people love one another. You know, Phil, yeah, I got right. on your the website for Fairfield Friends Meeting, where you serve, and right at the top of that page, I just want to read this quote, which consists of your words to introduce this meeting. "The people of Fairfield Friends Meeting in Cambie, Indiana, joyfully welcome all people to our meeting for worship. Gay, straight, black, brown, white, Republicans, Democrats, independents, dog people, cat people, vegetarians, meat eaters, wild-eyed liberals, middle of the roads, and dyed-in-the-wool conservatives." That's not the full list of folks I'm sure you welcome. I mean, I think I imagine if I liked horned lizards, I could get in there too. But
that's where we draw them.
Yeah, you got to have some standards, right? But it's a great way of saying this is who we are.
Yeah.
Right.
Naming it.
Right, yeah.
And also, I think too, I think there's a lot of wringing of hands and lamentation for people who have been, as I said in the beginning of the podcast, touched by experiences with the ideas of radical love in the Gospels, right?
And yes.
So there's a sense that you know, there's a lot of wringing of hands that churches are shrinking, that post-COVID, you know, what is the trajectory? And again, I'm finding those communities that are naming it and being clear. Because honestly, you know, if the church is not talking about justice, if it's not talking about climate change, if it's not talking about living in their community and also in the community, as a presence in the community, there's nothing for young people there. And
I know, that's right. Yeah. If they show up and hear a negative word about gay people or trans people, forget it. They won't stay, and I don't blame them.
Yeah.
One thing that I think has to happen, I get reviewed once a year. It's a performance review. It's actually fun because I get to review the meeting and they get to review me. So that just happened. And one of the comments, and it's a perennial comment, and I think I know the person who says it. It's the same person every year. Says they like everything about me except that I'm too political. And I don't know how many times I have said in my 25 years there, politics is simply the way we live together. And if that is not a subject of the church, then something is wrong. I think that has been a masterful stroke by people who want nothing to change, by people who benefit from the current order, by convincing the rest of us that politics should not be discussed in the church. And I think it should be the primary focus of the church, because it is about how we live together, the kind of community we form, and who we love and who we don't. Mm-hmm. And that must be foremost in the church, not excluded from it.
Yeah. Someday, along the lines of persuasion and rhetoric, we can have a longer conversation about the pre-political layer of our life, of which the church is part, and of which community building is also a part. I think one of the language problems we have is that people confuse the word politics with the name of a candidate, with their position on an issue, with, you know, the act of voting every couple of years, when in fact we would, I think, reach easier agreement that there's this layer of our common life on which politics depends, and it has to do with the things you just named, Phil. Mm-hmm. Who we love and how we love them, and what we fear in relation to all of that, mm-hmm. what we have hope for, and the mm-hmm. communities that carry those conversations. It's the kind of thing Alexis de Tocqueville talked about in Democracy in America, on which a healthy political system depends. And without a healthy pre-political layer of life, a communal layer of life, you don't have democracy, period. You have totalitarianism, period. That's just the name of the game. And I think we need to be talking about how already today we have marks of a totalitarian society in our midst. And I would point quickly, for example, to the number of people who find that it's unsafe to talk about their beliefs among family and friends. That's one of the oldest tricks of a would-be totalitarian dictator, is to smash the social bonds, the social fabric, and make it unsafe for people to talk about things that matter.
Right.
Because if you can't talk about things that matter, how do you ever get corporate momentum in those directions?
Right.
So this is a really, I think it's a very rich conversation. Yeah.
We have a little newspaper here in Danville, oddly enough, called The Republican. It's been around since 1848. And it was purchased by a man 4 years ago who bought the building in which the newspaper was contained and didn't realize until after he had purchased the building that the newspaper came with it. He had no background in journalism. He was a real estate guy. But he grew intrigued at the idea of owning his own newspaper. And in the 4 years he's owned it, has doubled the subscription rate. And he called me 2 years ago. He said, "Phil, we need to be talking about things." He said, "I want you to write a monthly column. And I'm going to get Gary Varville, who is a national editorial cartoonist who also grew up in Danville, whom I've known. And he's going to write the conservative side." Well, Gary was all in for Trump and Pence, and is personal friends with Mike Pence. So we pick a topic, and I handle the progressive side of it. Gary writes the conservative side. And it is an absolute joy to be part of that conversation. Yeah. Someone was telling me, "Well, once you start writing that, you'll no longer be able to live in your town."
Wow.
Like many small Indiana towns, Danville is considered, you know, to be pretty traditional. But I've been amazed at the response. people who I never thought would agree with me, who have come up and said, thank you for doing that. Thank you for saying that. It needs to be said. And I think we're reaching a tipping point when the ugliness of what faces us is now so apparent that that reasonable people want nothing to do with it.
I think you're right. And one sign, to reference something you just referenced, is that Mike Pence is no longer for Trump and Pence.
That's right. And Senator Todd Young from Indiana came out and said he would not support Donald Trump for the presidency.
Wow.
And is catching flack for it on his Facebook page, I noticed. But I also noticed that it's about a 3-to-1 ratio, that he is receiving far more warm words of support and encouragement than denigration.
It takes a certain amount of courage, you know, and finding where that courage comes from, you know, in terms of, on your Substack page recently, there was a quote I loved. I would rather be slapped by the truth than kissed by a lie, you know.
Yeah.
I immediately underlined that. But this idea of taking the risk, you know, what Parker said is true. We, you know, there's this encouragement to not be in conversation with each other across our differences and find where we still connect, because that's what happens too. And that's one of the things I love about your books. You do often get to the heart of the human story and you know, whatever our political views are, you know, affect them, but continuing to get to the heart of the human story. And that idea of being courageous, taking the risk of having sometimes those hard conversations, the things that support that, having a community that support those conversations and are a resource.
Oh, yeah.
Recently, someone and I were talking a lot about whether or not she should speak with somebody about a particular encounter that bothered her. And where's the grounding and where's the value system and how to do that in ways that are loving but true, but really true to yourself,
right,
and true to your values.
Right.
And I think I really appreciate, as we get close to the end of our program, which I think I could sit here and talk with you like all day long, Phil.
Same here.
With Parker. Oh my gosh, this is like, you know, one of my dream conversations. But, you know, this idea of seeing models. And Phil, you've been a real model, I think, for myself and for a lot of people, of speaking the truth with love, but completely authentically and true to your values. And I thank you for doing that. And, you know, thank you so much for being part of this conversation today.
And thank you, Phil, for bringing a laugh while you do it. I read a recent piece you wrote in the Indianapolis Monthly, and I'll just quote a very brief part of it. You're writing about an aunt that you like who lives half the year in Indiana, and she spends the other half of her year in Florida, a state that, as you say, has always annoyed me for reasons I don't fully understand, but deeply feel. And I thought, that's my guy right there, yes. And then you say, this illustrates the complexity of shunning other people, which of course is going around a lot these days, because so you've decided that you'll shun your aunt while she's in Florida, but then accept her when she comes back to Indiana, which I think is really a splendid strategy. Kind of allows you to maintain.
You are dead to me.
Yeah. Allows you to maintain your integrity while still being borderline insane, you know.
Oh, you know, I tell you what, you know who I admire. I look at, sometimes people come to me and say, oh, you're so brave. And I think, I'm not brave. They can't throw me in jail.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
right.
know? I tell you who I admire. I admire the Russians who are standing up to Vladimir Putin.
Yep.
And letting him know that they do not support his treachery, even unto death,
as
we've seen recently. How do you do that? How do you stand against that man knowing it will cost you your life and yet you do it anyway? I marvel at people like that.
I marvel at every member of every marginalized group in the United States of America who's participated in movements of liberation that involve having a public voice, because they pay a price for that.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And the price is extracted by people of no courage, people hiding behind right. their own wealth and power. Not a fit way for an adult to live, but these brave, brave transformational agents of change really draw my admiration and respect. Yeah. Thanks for being one of them, Philip Gully.
Yes, thank you, Phil.
Thank you for your kind words.
Take good care. You've been listening to The Growing Edge with Carrie Newcomer and Parker Palmer.
Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you'll check out our next episode.
And don't forget to visit our website, newcomerpalmer.com, and our Growing Edge Substack page, so you can join in the conversation too.
And now we have a favor to ask. If you like today's show, rate us and leave a review on iTunes. It's the best way to help us reach new audiences and bring more voices into this conversation.
All the music you heard on today's show was written by our own Carrie Newcomer. And much gratitude to Gary Walters for performing the song, The Clean Edge of Change.
And wild appreciation to Allison Quance for creative envisioning, direction, production, and because she's another voice for change.